Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
I want to come to you first because you really are the person more than anybody in the country, as I said earlier, who has studied generations and especially this one. Paul touched on this at several points, but what are some of the main ways this younger generation is different from boomers when we were younger, Gen X when they were younger, and the others?
Thank you, Judy. First of all, I just want to thank Pew for doing this study. For those of us who have been talking about generations for a long time, it's great to have, you know, all of you come out and talk about a generation. Social scientists talk about the cohort effect all the time, but they don't often talk about entire generations. Can you pass me just a...
Sure.
I'm tethered here and I can't move. someone wired me up, so I can't move. Hold on one second. Thank you very much. And as well that you use the name Millennial Generation, which is, I recall it was in the late 1980s when Bill and I were writing our first book, Generations, the History of America's Future, which is sort of a generational biography of America going back to the 17th century. And we were wondering about what to name the 14th generation, and we were coming up with different names. And Bill said, well, you know, the first one of them is coming along in 1982. They're going to be the high school class of 2000. And I bet you ABC and all these networks are going to have big shows about the high school class of 2000. What do you say we name them Millennials? So anyway, that's how the name was invented once upon a time. I think it was around 1980. We made some predictions at that time about millennials that no one believed. We said that due to their location in history, this generation, by the time it became teenagers, would cause a huge decline in many of the measures of social pathology associated with youth. We said that the crime rate would go down, teen abortion, teen pregnancy, some of the most dangerous measures of drug use would go down. And indeed, I think that was kind of amazing that by the late 1990s and shortly after the year 2000, we saw all of those indicators shift. And I think that's one of the things to keep in mind about millennials. They may say that the boomers have all these values and these boomers are so much more moral people than they were. But it's just remembering that when boomers were coming of age, we had 17 uninterrupted years of declining SAT scores, rising drug use, rising teen pregnancy, rising suicide, rising rates of self-inflicted accidents, rising crime. Of that crime, the share that was violent was rising. Basically, everything moved in that direction. Millennials have been moving most of these indicators in the opposite direction, and that's truly remarkable. I think to answer your question, Judy, just about what makes them different, you have to talk first, this is true of any generation, you have to talk about location in history. Location in history is what shapes a generation. And I think it's very useful to think about that period from the mid-1960s, maybe all the way to the early 1980s, the consciousness revolution, what some historians call America's fourth or fifth great awakening, what Francis Fukuyama calls the great disruption in American culture over recent decades. That was a period where each generation locates itself in a different way. Boomers came of age into adulthood during that period. And that's when we acquired a reputation for reshaping values, reshaping the culture. We were the counterculture. We were consciousness three. We were the greening of America. We were all of those things. And now that we're in midlife, we still think that all values revolve around ourselves. So, you know, back then, any discussion of values back in the 1970s was a discussion about college kids. Older people back then apparently didn't have any values. We never talked about them. And today, most discussions of values today are about midlife people. It's red zone, blue zone, it's culture wars, it's boomers arguing with each other. So boomers always go through their life telling other generations what's good and what's bad, what's right and what's wrong. That's how they're wired. But that was the result of that location in history. Generation X were the children of that period. And that hugely influenced them. They were the throwaway kids, the latchkey and self-care guide kids. And they grew up at a time when children were basically not wanted. They're also the lowest result of the lowest fertility rate in American history. Fertility rate reached its all-time low around the time of Watergate in 1974. And they grew up at a time when childhood was devalued. I don't know if you recall all the Child is Devil horror movies of the 1970s. You know, Rosemary's Baby and Omen and Damien and It's Alive. And, you know, they played to packed theaters back then. That was our image of childhood. The millennial generation arrived when the consciousness revolution was over. And I think that is how you define its location in history. Boomers remember it coming of age. Xers remember it as children. Millennials don't remember it at all. So Woodstock is an SOL question to millennials today. It's as remote from them as talk about the New Deal is from a boomer like myself. They don't remember it. They don't remember anything associated with it in their own lives. And in fact, when they came along was precisely a time at which childhood was revalued again in America. This was a period, the early 80s, when suddenly things began improving for children. Alcohol consumption per capita among all Americans has been gradually declining since about 1981. Drug use among all Americans have been gradually declining. The abortion rate, the divorce rate have all been gradually declining. I don't know if you recall the early 1980s, it was the year of the yuppie, finally getting settling down. It was family values, it was cocooning. In 1982, when the first millennials were born, we saw the appearance of baby on board bumper stickers all across America. Right? We'd never seen that before. And suddenly, all those Child is Devil movies, no one wanted to watch them. It was all these cuddly baby movies. You remember Baby Boom and Parenthood and Three Men and a Baby started coming out. And then about 10 years later, there were, you know, happy movies about adolescence, movies like Sleepless in Seattle and Searching for Bobby Fischer. And today, in fact, a very common kind of movie. You see this all the time. These are kids who basically inspired their parents to become better people. And you see this especially now when you have later wave millennials with Xer parents. A typical plot line now is, you know, millennial kid puts Xer dad into rehab or something like that. I mean, it's just, we're used to that today. At the same time this happened, this new image of childhood, came a new protection of children. And this is important to remember. Things like child abuse and what was in their Halloween bags and bicycle, you know, helmets and protective playground materials, all of this became into fashion. Fathers present at the birth of their children, even in the late 1970s, only about 20%. By the late 1980s, thanks to the Lamaze movement, about 65%. Today, it's over 70%. So these were huge shifts. The entire home protection industry, all those gadgets you put on your plugs and your stoves and so on, those are self-made devices back in the 1970s. It's incredible to remember. Parents just kind of made those themselves. That became a multi-billion dollar industry by the late 1980s. So all these things began to shift. And when parents couldn't protect kids personally, they started deputizing government to step in. The last 25 years have seen one of the great child protection movements in American history. Every bit as big as what happened during the progressive era in the first two decades of the 20th century under, you know, Roosevelt and Taft. You think of all of the laws now even named after millennials, you know, like Megan laws, or there's now a Code Adam. You know, some kid is lost in a Walmart, bam, all the doors shut, no one gets in or out until that one child is found. But we're very used to this now throughout our society and culture, of this new protection. And let me use that as a way to kind of get in the payoff, I think, of what you were asking. So what are the basic ways that it really differs, this new location in history? One is the sense of specialness. They're special. They're special in the eyes of the media, politicians, their community, and above all, their parents. These kids have been raised with William and Martha Sears attachment parenting. You know, the parents are always around. And we've looked at a lot of surveys comparing parents actually saying, you know, do I spend more time with my kid than my parents spent with me? Back in the 1980s, those surveys showed that parents generally said, no, I don't spend as much time. Today, decisively, particularly with parents of the younger millennials, they say overwhelmingly, I spend much more time with my kids than my own parents spent with me. So, I mean, that's an indicator of what's going on. Teachers, K through 12 teachers, according to the last 6 years of the MetLife survey, say that parents are their number one professional problem. Okay, these parents are in their face constantly. And one of the things I do when I talk to groups about dealing with parents is you can't straight on them. You can't say to these parents, get out of here, I'm the professional. You've just made your worst enemy if you do that. Okay, they have the fear and loathing and hatred in that parent. What you have to do is you have to channel the energy. You have to basically say, okay, together we're going to raise this great child. I'm going to do this, and you're going to do that, and together we'll get it. You have to partner it. This is what colleges are now doing, these huge, elaborate freshman orientations. They pass out the teddy bears, and all those boomers are crying, you know. Some institutions really get it. I don't know if you've seen recently the U.S. Army recruiting slogan. You've seen those ads, right, with the parents and kids that are looking at their careers together. But the slogan really gets it. You made them strong, we'll make them Army strong, right, which is perfect. It's the partnership. And you see this. And now the new message is for employers. Get used to, you know, meet the parent of these. There's going to be a bring your parent to work week. It's coming. And they're on the phone with their parents anyway, so you might as well just meet them. And they're telling their kids things about they should get benefits and make sure you get a pension plan and, you know, stay there for the long term and all that. So they're cheerleading for the kids. Anyway, get to know them. But that's one thing, the specialness. The other thing is the sheltering. And this sheltering is huge. They're aware, and you see, for Xers had a mixed feelings about sheltering. Because with an Xer, you sheltered him, and two thoughts came to their mind. First of all, they would ask, well, why do I trust you to shelter me? You know, it's that natural skepticism. You know, what's your real agenda here? And the other thing is, what's the message here? I can't take care of myself? You know, that's kind of the Xer response. You know, I'm not tough enough. You know, what's going on? The millennials have no problem with sheltering. The millennial response is, I get it. I'm special. You want to protect me. I mean, what's the matter here? I don't have any problem with that. So sheltering is big, and you see that in every institution dealing with young people. Sheltering?
What is it?
What do you mean, what is it?
Protecting, providing for.
Providing protections for kids. In other words, all of these laws and rules and regulations, just look at graduated license laws now in most states where you have to go through this elaborate procedure. Okay, now 2.5 people plus a dog can be in your car while you're driving. Next month it'll be something else. Another huge trend, and I don't want to spend much time, is the confidence. And I think you covered that. The incredible confidence of this generation. It's causing them in the midst of the recession not just to take the first jobs that gives them cash, but to say, no, I've got longer-term goals. I'm going to live at home. I'm going to go to school. I'm not giving up that longer-term dream. One huge difference, and this is something that we pay a lot of attention to in this generation, and that is this ethic of teamwork and community. And you see this most dramatically in what they spend most of their time thinking about and doing, which is their technology. And I want to just touch on that because I think it's so important. People often ask the question, how does technology shape a generation? And that's an interesting question, but it's usually the wrong question. The much more interesting and fruitful question is, how does a generation shape technology? Much more interesting question. Because if you look at that, you see, who invented the personal computers and why? Well, it was Bill Gates and Steve Jobs in the late 70s, early 80s. Why? Because they wanted to get away from those huge mainframe IBMs that had been designed by their GI generation parents. The idea was that all the information went to the top of an information organizational pyramid. Someone crunched the data, and then all the orders went down, right, throughout the organization. Boomers said, no, we each want an individual think station on our own desk, separate from anyone else, so we can be personally creative. And that was the whole 1984 won't be like 1984 ads, you remember, in the 1980s, and Apple and everything taking off. Gen X took this theme of individualizing and individuating the technology further with the internet, particularly with web commerce and everything they did. But here's the surprise, and here's the real trend breaker. Millennials are taking this technology, and to everyone's surprise, when they were growing up, you know, when they were growing up, they came home, and the first thing they wanted to do on the computer was, well, they wanted to email their friend, and then they wanted to go in the chat room, and then it was IM, and then it was Facebook and MySpace, and now it's these cell phones, which have a little marauder's map. You can track every single one of your buddies all day, 24/7. But the point is, they're moving technology back to the community. And in fact, they're revitalizing and galvanizing political campaigns and community action through technology. This was not designed or anticipated by older people. This was driven by young people. And you see this in hugely higher rates of community service and volunteering. I mean, let's face it, for Gen X, volunteering was a punishment. You know, you did something wrong in college, you do community service. And the Gen Xer would say, why me of all people, you know? But the millennials, it's more of a norm. And so that is huge. And maybe just one last thing to comment on is how conventional this generation is. Conventional in a very important way, and it often surprises boomers. You ask them what they want to do as they get older, and they say, they have very conventional answers. I want to have a balanced life. I want to be a good citizen and a good neighbor. According to the UCLA freshman poll, an unprecedented share say they want to get married and have kids eventually, much higher than it was for boomers. You ask them how they want to spend their time, and they say, I want to spend time with my parents. And it gets back to this whole revitalization of the extended family, which is going on today. And even their attitudes toward issues like gay marriage and minorities getting along with each other is very much driven by this sense that we should all have a place, we should all have a family, we should all be brought into the mainstream. There's a complete absence of the stigmatizing that goes on so often with boomers. And I think in that sense, that underlying that is a great sense of conventionality. They want to take things and make them conventional so that we can all celebrate them, we can all enjoy them, and everyone can fit in and have a place that way. No one has to shock anyone, you know, like boomers were constantly doing at the same age.
Neil, I let you go on a long time because everybody can see he's just a gold mine of history and information about this generation and just some wonderful context that you gave us.
I have a question. How many layers of irony do you have to wade through to truly understand the most infamous, untrusted, suspect item to grace the cafe breakfast menus of the modern world? I'm talking, of course, about avocado toast. As I'm sure you're aware, avocado toast started off as a boomer and Gen X insult to trash young, teenage, and early 20s hospitality workers and uni students, many of whom get pissed on cheap booze and live either at home or in overcrowded share houses, where they subsist largely on two-minute noodles and more cheap booze. The one, at least stereotypical, luxury for this cohort has tended to be the moderately expensive brunch they buy once a fortnight or so that they can upload a photograph of said brunch to an Instagram story that will last for 24 hours to temporarily create the mirage of a life that is far less put together than the way too crusty sourdough would have you believe. How wasteful. The thing is, this trope is so overused that I've heard it refuted more times than it's actually been stated. You know the drill, you know what I'm talking about. Thanks a lot for the advice, Boomer. If I give up my weekly avocado toast, I'll be able to afford my own home in an outer suburb of my city in only 875 years, assuming property prices remain constant that entire time, ha ha ha. And because I've heard that refutation just about as much as I've heard the original Boomer financial advice, I honestly now have no clue how many layers of sarcasm, irony, or quadruple reverse psychology mind games I need to play to now provide a hot take on this issue. So, let's try and work out together why I'm talking about this. The avocado toast trope is just a euphemism for a widely held perception by older generations about young people. That perception being, young people are lazy. Therefore, the avocado toast trope is synonymous with young people won't get off their phones, young people won't take any responsibility, young people aren't willing to work hard, young people can't manage their finances, and young people need to go out into the country and pick some f***ing fruit and learn the value of a hard day's work. The avocado toast is an allegory for all of these sentiments. Now, are you ready for my hot take reversaroo right now? You know what? These insults are all correct. You bet there are a bunch of young people floating around, addicted to their phones, not knowing the value of a hard day's work, who take too many photos of their food and who are not investing their money responsibly. You f***ing bet there are a lot of young people whose digital selves are so intertwined with their in-person selves that their ability to function in the outside world is so significantly impaired that without Google Maps they get lost searching for the toilet. You bet. A decent chunk of young people are seriously unimpressive human beings. I shudder at the thought of this cohort of individuals attempting to function in a world that is not artificially designed with the assistance of a small team communicating on Discord or whatever. But do you know what else is true? It's not young people's fault. Young people are miserable, lazy, stressed, depressed, weaker than previous generations and scared of everything. But it's not their fault. You've probably heard the narrative around how tech companies and social media businesses all have very, very smart people employed to make people as addicted as humanely possible to their products. It's in the zeitgeist. Netflix have made documentaries about it. You've probably heard it enough that it's kind of water off a duck's back by this point, right? The whole social media bad for your brain thing. But that doesn't make it any less true. It really is. Young people grew up surrounded by iPhones, iPads, and all that other cyborg shit in their formative years. That's unprecedented and pretty scary when you step back. We've existed as a species for millions of years, and we didn't start farming until 12,000 years ago. Now we have supercomputers in our pockets all of a sudden. Our brains aren't meant for that. Young people didn't even have an opportunity for their brains to develop before meeting these sophisticated, addictive sci-fi technologies that are now so integrated with every aspect of everyone's lives. What f***ing chance do young people have to not be acutely addicted to all this stuff? I mean, I am. I'm in my mid-20s and I reckon my capacity to sit down and read a book is probably worse now than it was when I was 10. That doesn't mean you can't do anything about it. You can. But you've got a fight on your hands that the boomers didn't need to wage in their formative years. So, anyway, I have gone off on a tangent. So far, I've explained why heaps of young people are comparatively sad and unimpressive, but I should probably now link all that to the actual topic of this video, right? You see, on top of all these factors making young people stressed and depressed and anxious and directionless, young people are also f***ing broke. Millennials are the first generation destined to be worse off financially than their parents, and we're seeing a, quote, growing divide between a more prosperous older generation and a struggling younger generation. There's data to support all this, but I actually prefer thinking about this in terms of anecdotes. If you're a boomer and you grew up in a reasonably well-off country, there's a good chance that you didn't go to university, but graduated high school into a well-paying 40-hour-a-week job. You married someone who probably did the same thing, and then one of you, probably the lady, left the workforce entirely because just that one remaining single high school graduate level 40 hour a week job was still enough money with which to buy a house, have a few kids, put them all through school, and keep two cars in the garage before retiring comfortably into significant wealth because the value of the house you purchased all that time ago has risen by 15,000%. Meanwhile, the current generation has people with multiple university degrees, unable to find a minimum wage job to pay their rent in a dodgy share house, work 60 hours a week at a bar or delivering food to cover this, and then stays home the rest of the time checking their social media because that's easier than facing up to the fact that even though telephones are better now, the world's still really unfair. And then, goes the stereotype, the baby boomers call those people lazy and entitled. Now, I accept that this is a stereotype. I know a lot of baby boomers, and some of them genuinely do suck, but most of them are pretty nice. Just as how, I reckon, deep down, most people at least have the capacity to be very nice when they choose to. But none of the boomers I've met seem to be complaining about that 15,000% capital gain they've received on the family home. These gains didn't come about as conscious decisions, but they are a consequence of economic trends over time that have shaped the political and economic institutions of the modern world. It's harder to get ahead now for a lot of reasons, but some of them are: mid-level jobs are being automated away, wage growth has been stagnant for years, getting a decent education is now harder and more expensive, taxes a percentage of income have gone up and now have to fund a massive, continuously growing social safety net, in part because the massive cohort of boomers discussed previously are now hitting retirement age, and there's evidence that productivity has significantly slowed down in general over the past couple of decades, and we seem to be hitting a global period of low growth compared to the era of the boomer. We have lived for years in an anemic economy punctuated by economic crises, with low interest rates only slightly offsetting massive increases in asset prices. No f***ing wonder it's hard to get ahead. But the part that really digs the knife in is the extra bonus part I haven't gotten to yet. You see, you can add an extra factor on top of all this stuff that really contributes to the boomer hatred specifically, one that actually is kind of pernicious. And that's that the economy has been specifically set up in a way that benefits older generations more. So on top of all the other stuff, the economy is set up in a way that benefits old people, not young people. The baby boomers have safety in numbers, right? Their demographic cohort is bigger than Gen X, than Gen Y, or millennials, or Zoomers, or whatever. Because coming out of the Second World War, everyone wanted to have kids. So because there's a lot of people, that means something else. There's a lot of votes in this cohort. Over time, boomers have successfully advocated for laws that favoured their demographic cohort specifically. They benefited from free uni education and a booming economy, and now benefit from measures to ensure property and other asset prices remain high. No politician in their right mind will touch an estate tax or reconsider the range of measures established to ensure the other assets the older generation have accrued, such as shares, continue to provide passive income through, for example, franking credit offsets. In Australia, Labor tried to wind back a couple of these policies, and in doing so, they lost an unlosable election in 2019. In the next election 3 years later, they revived none of these policies. The boomers are a powerful voting cohort, and they are far more powerful than young people. They sway constituencies and shape political careers. The implications of this are crystal clear. Boomers are a politically and economically protected species. Now, like I've said, I like a lot of boomers. Some of my best friends are boomers. They're fine. But in economic terms, they have been lucky. And the consequences of this are pretty interesting. The concentration of wealth in the hands of boomers over time has meant that not only has intergenerational inequality increased, it's placed a larger importance on inheritance, as noted by Thomas Piketty, one of the few economists able to write a long, dense, boring book about economics that people somehow all still seem to want to buy. So in essence, because boomers have accrued a disproportionate amount of global wealth, their descendants will inherit this wealth. Wealth will play a greater role over time than income, which will increase inequality further across generations. This is because your wealth will depend very, very strongly on whatever wealth was held by the boomer ancestors in your family. For example, my grandpa's high school entry-level insurance job that he held for decades and, to be fair, hated, was the nest egg that has now impacted the financial security of three generations of his descendants far more than anything else in our family history. So, wealth builds over time, and it concentrates itself in the hands of those who already hold wealth, rather than those generating their own incomes. This is the central point of Piketty's book. Increasing inequality is a feature of capitalism, but one especially interesting takeaway from this is the intergenerational implication. You see, the people who already hold the capital aren't just anyone, they're disproportionately boomers who first benefited from a growing economy that made it easy to accrue wealth and now benefit from a taxation system that makes it easy to hang on to. And when there are fewer incentives for wealth to be reallocated to its most productive uses, you see inequality grow up and growth go down, both of which are happening. So how do you level things out? You counter one of those two things. We either increase the rate of economic growth, or we decrease the returns on capital through higher taxation and more redistribution. The latter, which you could achieve through a combination of large domestic hikes to income tax and a global wealth tax, is even noted by Thomas Piketty himself as politically impossible to the scale with which any benefit would be realised. In Australia, it would mean probably starting with the series of reforms that Labor would have implemented if they'd won the 2019 election. But they lost that election, and with it most of their progressive policy ambition. So in the long run, the only real way to level out the intergenerational playing field is with productivity gains that increase economic growth higher than the rate of return on capital held by existing wealth holders. More smart young people need to go out and make new, cool things that make people's lives better. More smart young people need to go out and create meaningful products and good art and great music and bridges and technologies and medical devices and spaceships and trains and economic growth levels out inequality by increasing incomes relative to the return on capital already held by people that are already rich, the boomers. So, to end on a slightly less depressing note, the future is in the hands of young people. At no point of this rambling do I suggest that growing up back in the day was better. An interest in farm work I do not personally have. I enjoy my computer, I enjoy YouTube, I enjoy nice beer, and I enjoy not eating corned beef and potatoes every night. The modern world is great in heaps of ways, and now is a great time to be young in heaps of ways. In some ways it's harder to get ahead, but there's also a world of opportunity out there if you're willing to go out and take it. The truth is though, it's going to be a slog, it's going to be hard. Take up the challenge, but don't let a boomer get on your back if you decide you want to fuel yourself with an overpriced brunch now and again. A little bit of overpriced crusty toast never hurt anyone, all right? Catch you later.
It's great to welcome back to the program today Neil Howe, the acclaimed historian, economist, demographer, and also New York Times bestselling author of The Fourth Turning Is Here, as well as over a dozen books on demographic and social change. You know, Neil, last time we spoke, it was 2017, and we talked to you a little bit about where you saw the country and the globe in terms of stage and positioning with regard to these cycles and frameworks of societal change that you've written so much about. I'm curious, how would you assess where the last 6 years since you and I spoke have changed or moved us within this framework?
Well, it's been, 6 years since then, 2017 to 2023, and look, I mean, clearly we're further into the fourth turning that Bill and I wrote about, you know, I don't know, 25 years ago, and closer to what we call the ekpyrosis, or you know, the consolidation and climax of this period, which we expect to end in the early 2030s. It's back then. The geopolitical tensions have risen considerably. I think it's fair to say we have a major land war in Europe. We have a threat of war in the Western Pacific. We now have new threats of war in the Mideast. And I think most worrisomely, and this is where we see the parallel to the 1930s, is the sort of the superpower alignment, right? A realignment of major powers where you can see everyone sort of siding up on one side or the other, you know, pro-Western, anti-Western, if you want to call it that. The other thing we saw back then in 2017, although maybe hints of it were seen in the 2016 election, Clinton against Trump, is the growing specter of partisan conflict within the United States, the growing polarization of red zone and blue zone. Back then, the question of civil war in America was not even on the radar screen. We didn't even ask questions about it. Today, it's routinely asked, and, you know, Americans say, about half of them say, you know, we're likely to see something big happening in that regard in the next few years. And also the pessimism of the country with regard to its long-term future has usually increased, right? People are very pessimistic about where America is heading. And of course, that furthers their taste for confrontation, maybe in a way that will make it better. You know, maybe one side needs to win, or maybe we need to put democracy aside for a while. One thing that I've certainly noted is around the world, not just in the United States, but the declining faith that the rising generation has in sort of liberal democracy and due process. There's a growing impatience with that, and you see that in the rise of so many of these charismatic, populist, and somewhat authoritarian, and sometimes ethnocentric leaders all over the world. You see it in India, China, the Philippines. You see it in Southern Europe. You see it in Latin America. It's not just here. You know what I mean? It's around the world. And a big point of our book, actually, is that these generational changes have become global. The Great Depression and World War II were global events. And the awakening that we saw by younger generations challenging the strong institutions of their war-winning elders back in the late 60s and 1970s was also global. It was not just in Berkeley University in Columbia, but it was in Paris, it was in Prague, it was in Berlin, it was in Rome, it was in Beijing, it was the Red Guard, you know, the Cultural Revolution against their parents. It was around the world. So we think these patterns, these turnings patterns, are global. They're increasingly global.
What sort of role or importance did what happened about halfway between your last conversation with me and today, January 6, 2021, what sort of a role or importance does that have in your analysis? And if it doesn't, then that's fine too.
Role of what exactly?
In terms of your assessment of where we are in this cycle, you've talked about the combustibility sort of that can take place when there is a lack of a unifying experience within a country. One might argue that January 6th was the exact opposite. It was a fracturing experience in that or any other sense.
Well, you know, a fracturing experience to one side can be unifying for the other. And let's not forget that among the fourth turnings we've experienced in American history, and sort of Anglo-American history, really going back centuries, is both external conflict and internal conflict. And very often we fight both at the same time. The 1930s, I think, was thought of as an extraordinarily partisan, bitterly divided time for America. With the New Deal, I mean, half of America thought of it as the Red Decade, and the other half thought of it as the Fascist Decade. But then, unexpectedly, and for reasons that I outline in the book, the nation was able to unite around World War II and conquering half the world in a fight against global fascism. But that was an extraordinary end that no one would have predicted, right? As late as the very late 1930s. So it remains on a razor edge, right? Which way America goes. But that's certainly one big question that I often get asked.
When there are predictions as there have been for, I don't know, 10, 15 years, that along the lines of foreign policy, you know, you had a group of people that in 2015 started saying, if Hillary Clinton is elected, she'll start three wars. In the lead up to the election of President Joe Biden in 2020, you had a contingent of folks saying, if Joe Biden is elected, he's going to get us into World War III. Analogously, there have been folks predicting a major economic recession or depression from about the same time or even 2014, 2013. It seems as though if you're always predicting these things, eventually it will happen. And that does not necessarily mean that the predictions at the time that they were made were particularly insightful or interesting. Can you talk a little bit about those who were always predicting the same thing all the time, and then it eventually happens because it's a feature or a part of the way the country is organized or the world is organized? What are we to glean from those sorts of predictions? Are they useful? Are they interesting?
Well, I can't vouch for other people's predictions. I can only talk about my own track record. And when we wrote about this in 1997,
right,
it was sort of late in the Clinton presidency, and we said, look, we have another 7 or 8 or 9 years to go in what we call the third turning, which is going to be a time of great individualism, market boom. You know, things were going to be fine. And then we're going to hit this fourth turning, which was going to be a generation long, and it was going to extend through the 2020s. So we didn't always predict there was going to be bad news. We sort of said when it was going to occur and over what time period it would ramp up, it would climax. So I really haven't changed. What we did predict would be a catalytic event sometime in the first decade of the 20th century. We suggested 2005. It turned out to be 2008. I mean, it was the GFC. Mm-hmm. And that was really kind of a huge divide in trends, right? I mean, suddenly global trade was expanding as a share of global product. It's been shrinking ever since. Democracy was expanding around the world. It's been shrinking ever since 2008, right? Technology was supposed to overthrow dictators up until 2008. Ever since then, dictators have embraced technology, the internet, social media. You can whip crowds into a frenzy with it, and you can also surveil your own population perfectly. These are all huge changes in the use of technology and in the social mood and the increasing impatience of younger generations for a world that is kind of gridlocked and seems sclerotic, particularly the liberal democracies seeming unable to respond to this, both unable to respond to the changing world and also unable to respond to the aspirations of their own younger citizens or to retool their institutions and make them work properly. Again, for parallels, we see these earlier fourth turning decades, the most recent of which was, we all know, is the 2030s, although none of us remember them. And of course, that's part of the whole problem of a generational cycle, which takes a lifetime, is that we're always moving into an era that no one alive remembers, right?
What role does something like a pandemic, including the COVID-19 pandemic that took place since you and I last spoke and now, pandemics in general and or COVID specifically, how does that interact or intersect with the 80-year cycle that you talk about?
Well, we know something about pandemics. A lot of research has been done on them, even minor ones. I'm not talking about the Black Death or anything like that, or even the Spanish influenza. Mm-hmm. But we all know they generally tend to be bad for the economy. They tend to raise populist reform. In other words, they tend to radicalize and polarize the public in response, you know, to adjust to the changes that occur in its wake. So they are destabilizing for the economy and society. I think we can safely say no matter what the era, is one of the reasons why World War I was so badly remembered by America, because as soon as they came home, we had this horrible, you know, influenza, and we had back-to-back recessions. And I think this one was was particularly unique because of the extraordinary response of public policy, right? Mm. We had this huge stimulus response, which I think in retrospect seems a little bit all out of proportion to the hit to GDP. I mean, most households had huge growth in disposable income that they never would have had in a normal period absent the pandemic. And as a result, again, I think it's been destabilizing, but mainly due to just the increase in debt. I think increasing indebtedness is one of these huge challenges that the national government faces in the United States. We're up to, you know, over 100% of GDP in net, you know, publicly held federal debt, both at home and around the world. There may be other reasons in the not-too-distant future we need to run more debt. And if that's the case, we'll either need to find huge means of getting revenue or be cutting some of the expenditures we currently have. And right now, you know, looking at the House and just looking at government, we don't seem to be able to respond very well. So a lot of danger signals right going on right now.
Last thing I want to ask you about, and then I'll let you go. At the individual level, are there particular things that individuals can or should be doing in your mind to prepare for this coming part of the cycle?
Protect your portfolio. Inflation is always a huge problem in forth earnings. It's particularly a way in which governments get out from under their debt. That's been true of every forth earning going back centuries, right? That is a familiar technique that sovereigns use to get out from under. It was certainly part of World War II and its aftermath. And I think it will be necessarily again. Maybe people should have taken my advice 3 months ago before bond yields started going up. They would have saved themselves some pain. But my point is that that's characteristic. I think it changes how you want to invest in the S&P in terms of equities, probably looking a little bit more on things like defense and manufacturing and materials in a world in which we're kind of rebuilding the outer world and maybe not focusing so much on experiences. And most of all, I think it's a time for people to renew their ties from their family. Look, we've seen a huge renaissance of multi-generational living during this fourth turning. I mean, everyone's living with their parents and their grandparents. And I think that is in a almost semi-conscious prepping, you know, for a time at which a lot of the guarantees that governments and, you know, both federal and local have provided to people may not be there, right? We may have to depend upon each other more. Millennials generally get along well with their parents. I think the personally, generations get along well. And I think this will be a strength moving forward. And if people are wondering in an era of sort of government chaos and maybe a cutting back of generosity because we have other public agendas to attend to, where am I going to turn to for long-term care? Where am I going to turn to for a lot of these things? The lesson of fourth turnings is these are eras when we turn to our families.
We've been speaking with historian, economist, and demographer Neil Howe. We will link to his best-selling book. Neil, really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Safe here. The Eagle has landed.
We do not want an expanding struggle.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Passing the torch. The shaping of America's new leaders.
I'm Bonnie Anderson. Baby boomers now occupy the White House, most of the cabinet, half of the House of Representatives, and a quarter of the Senate. As John F. Kennedy said the last time there was such a shift in power, the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans, tempered by war, but for boomers a radically different one. A generation also disciplined by a hard and bitter peace. Yet this is a profoundly different group of men and women. The generation that once fought the establishment now is the establishment. What does this mean for the future of this nation? Well, the key to where we as a country are going lies in where we've been.
Boomer's parents, known as the GI generation, were raised in war and scarcity, darkness and depression.
General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered.
With the end of World War II, America rejoiced in the bright light of hope and optimism. Celebration on the battlefield turned into procreation in the bedroom. The number of babies boomed, jumping 19% in the first year after the war, another 12% over that the following year. The nation's largest generation to date, 70 million boomers, was well on its way. It was an age of promise and prosperity when parents vowed to make the sun shine on their victory children. And they did. Nothing was too good for their boomers. It was indeed a wonderful life. Co-authors Neil Howe and Bill Strauss have studied American generations.
They were the first babies who were raised under the Dr. Spock regimen of indulgent, permissive child rearing. Then they were the young children in the early 50s when it appeared that science could do anything to create a gleaming Tomorrowland for them in Disneyland, or to cure diseases like polio.
Over the next wondrous decades of accomplishment, the post-war babies grew up, touched and formed and molded by earth-shattering events, shattering illusions and some parents' hearts. The children of fast food and food for thought becoming a generation of more educated, more civil rights-minded, more accepting of women's equality, more environmentally conscious, obsessed with political correctness and ethical rectitude, but most of all, obsessed with values.
Boomers were raised not only to think, but they were also raised to feel and to feel things about justice, fairness, values, spirituality.
Giving us all a sense of new hope and limitless possibilities. That's what this new covenant is all about.
Those who know Bill Clinton say it's clear his past will have a tremendous influence on his and the world's future.
Now we have someone in public office who does seem to have been touched by some very important issues of Vietnam War, Watergate, and other things that have formed a cohesive sense of a generation.
From Dr. Spock babies to Mouseketeers, from hippies to yuppies to the PC policemen of the 1990s, a generation of shifting standards?
Other people look upon boomers as the most hypocritical generation perhaps in American history. But what you have to realize is that the generation that came of age passing stern judgment on right and wrong behavior of people of other ages is still doing the same thing. They're just doing it at a different age.
25 years ago, former Black Panther leader Bobby Rush supported the use of violence to force radical social change. He served 6 months on a weapons charge and is now serving 2 years in Congress. From prison stripes to pinstripes, times have changed, Congressman Rush says, but his 60s principles have not.
We have to try new approaches. I certainly never expected to be even living today. In the 60s, when I was a member of the Panther Party, I certainly expected to be killed by the police, and I did not expect to be a congressman.
While lives can take unexpected turns, historians say the path generations take as a whole is predictable, based on the past. Indeed, there have been four other boomer-like generations in this nation's development. The Puritans, Benjamin Franklin's contemporaries, and the generations of Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. Their life cycles were all marked by similar events, born after a great crisis or a great war, indulgently nurtured as children.
We found that in every case in American history, that kind of generation has gone on to come of age in their late teens and early 20s to attack the institutions of their elders, the symbolic institutions of their fathers in particular, and go on to make the defining of values and culture their main life purpose and focus.
The only thing we have to fear is...
Franklin Roosevelt's generation, known as the Missionaries, was the most recent such group. Born after the Civil War, they were pampered as youths and well-educated. They came of age during muckraking and fundamentalism, demanding social reforms. In midlife, the Missionary generation led the crackdown on drugs and alcohol. They redefined the role of women in public life, electing 19 to Congress. Only two women had ever served before. Later in life, they became the moral judges of other Americans.
I hope you'll vote.
But boomer-like generations judge their own contemporaries with equal harshness. As the first president of his generation, Bill Clinton is facing the most skepticism from boomers themselves. Indeed, in November, he polled best among people over 60 and under 24. Boomers, it appears, were afraid to trust one of their own with the most powerful job in the world.
Even among people who voted for Clinton, there was a certain anxiety about voting for someone his age, namely voting for a boomer. What will these people be like in power? And more to the point, what are they going to be like if you age this generation another 20 years? What kinds of attitudes will come to the surface?
One boomer who has spent a lifetime fighting for power now admits having it is daunting.
If you just take a moment to think about it, I mean, it might give you an occasion to break out in a cold sweat because it's a tremendous amount of responsibility.
Ahead on Passing the Torch, the death of heroes and innocents. Events that help shape the leaders of today.
Duck and cover.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent. Communist Party is a minority. The entire nation should be alerted to its menace today.
Crisis is developing. Its name is Cuba.
For boomers, growing up during the Cold War meant accepting the chilling, frightening notion of mortal enemies beyond our borders and within. Still, most Americans trusted their government to make the right decision, to protect them.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
When the torch was passed to John F. Kennedy, it touched off a new era of hope and idealism. Among those profoundly inspired by this young president, a high school student named Bill Clinton, who would become the country's first post-Cold War president.
I like being compared to him in the sense of raising people's hopes and vision and making people think we can move forward again.
Indeed, hope began dimming in 1963.
Martin Luther King, 20 minutes ago, died.
5 years later, the shadows grew darker with the death of another man seen as a hero by many.
And I've seen the promised land.
Freshman Congressman Mel Reynolds of Chicago.
One cannot help, if one grew up during those times, to not having been profoundly affected by it, and really creating this sense of, you just don't want to be here. You just don't want to be alive. You want to do something while you're alive, I think so.
The ultimate lesson of Martin Luther King's life, and the final reward in death, was the notion that all of us matter.
For boomers coming of age, it was also a tragic lesson that heroes die, that good does not always conquer evil. With Vietnam, many boomers were even more disillusioned, feeling government deceived and lied to its people.
I do not find it easy to send the flower of our youth, our finest young men, into battle.
Many young men, like Bill Clinton, today say they agonized over what to do. For the first time ever, a substantial portion of an American generation was debating whether all wars were just.
And it's 1, 2, 3, what do we fight for?
Of every 100 men eligible for the draft, only 6 saw combat. Among the rest, 2/3 say they intentionally dodged service. Some got married and had children. Others committed crimes.
All right, fellas, let's go. Move them out.
The social upheaval touched virtually everyone in some way. Yet only 10 to 15% of the youth of the day were the radicals or hippies.
We are all shaped by the times in which we live. But remember, not everyone joined the counterculture. Not everyone demonstrated, dropped out, took drugs, joined in the sexual revolution, or dodged the draft.
But those that did made the headlines and drove history. Still, it was not until protesters were killed at Kent State and Jackson State that a Gallup poll showed a majority of boomers opposed the war. For Bill Clinton, protesting and avoiding service may have cost him some votes, but it won him many others. Freshman congressman and former Black Panther Bobby Rush.
Most people in that class, in my class, actually stood up and gave a loud hoorah when they found out that Clinton had participated an anti-war demonstration.
Former U.S. Representative Thomas Downey, one of the first boomers in national office, says Vietnam cast a shadow on his generation's ability to trust government.
And it gave rise to a generation who looked at the United States government, who had grown up thinking the government does no wrong and operates solely in our interest, to being very much disheartened by the fact that the government wasn't operating in our interest and wasn't operating honestly. So there's a level of skepticism about authority, I think, etched in all of us.
Author Don Katz has known Clinton for many years.
As somebody marked profoundly by that, Clinton has to be aware that any warlike activity has to be something that has a moral basis that the public can accept.
Vietnam, says historian Neil Howe, simply did not appeal to most boomers' hearts and minds.
What appeals to boomers' natural instincts is a war of values, a war in which they can crusade for some ideal that they know is right and perhaps sacrifice for.
Which is why, he says, Clinton and many boomer members of Congress approve of sending troops to Somalia to help people live, not kill them.
It is a wonderful thing that America has decided, I should say, to go and be involved in a humanitarian effort, because I think it sends a tremendous signal across the world.
The committee will come to order.
What did the president know, and when did he know it?
I have never been a quitter.
Breaking the rules, lying, and cover-ups. For a generation obsessed with values, Watergate, for many, inspired even deeper mistrust in government. Indeed, it was the investigative work of two boomer journalists that prompted Richard Nixon's resignation. Freshman Republican Congresswoman Tilly Fowler, a boomer, worked for the Nixon White House.
I think there became a disillusionment with a lot of the public with government as a result of Watergate, and it's up to those of us who are serving now to try to regain that trust and confidence.
For Bill Clinton, that means an open and accountable administration.
I think all of this comes out of the traumatic experience of feeling for much of the formative years of the older group, the baby boom generation, that the government can betray you.
A generation leads the fight for equality when passing the torch continues.
Capcom, we're go for landing. Altitude 4200.
Houston, you're go for landing. Over.
That's one small step for man.
Boomers came of age during an age of widening horizons, a time of journeys to outer space. And on Earth, voyages to the interior.
It had the grooviest psychedelic high I've ever had.
Yeah.
Many members of the Me generation tested the limits of everything and judged everyone. Though the civil rights movement was well underway, it intensified as more and more young Americans questioned the moral basis for discrimination. Hundreds of thousands, including many of today's new leaders, marched on Washington, in Alabama, in towns and cities across America.
You name a civil rights demonstration that came through the city of Atlanta, I was there.
For many citizens, it was a time of inspiration.
I have a dream.
I never will forget sitting alone in my home and weeping like a little child on August the 28th, 1963, when he gave his I Have a Dream speech. Martin Luther King taught me as much as anybody, even though I never met him, about the power of words and conviction and love.
President Clinton says his civil rights instincts were awakened during his early childhood by his family's beliefs, by life in Arkansas. When he was only 11, 1,000 troops were sent to nearby Little Rock to escort and protect the first 9 black students at Central High School. Newly appointed Ambassador-at-Large Strobe Talbot was Clinton's college roommate.
You now have in charge people who were, if not present at the creation, then at least present and active in an extremely important stage of the battle for civil rights in this country, who are now finally in a position to really see it through to the next stage.
There is a place for all of us in the American dream. We don't have to step on each other. We don't have to hurt each other. All we have to do is communicate with each other.
Equal pay for equal work.
Indeed, American women in the 60s and 70s did hear and learn from the cry for racial equality. And today, many feminists acknowledge the women's movement owes a debt to the civil rights movement.
Once you start to question a caste system based on race, you can't fail but to question it based on sex, based on ethnicity, and other conditions of birth. So in that sense, it came as a natural outcome of the civil rights movement.
I'm the holy granddaughter of women.
Yet feminists say the movement is still in its infancy. One reason? Among boomers, says Steinem, there's no consensus on women's equality.
I think the only thing that the generation shares is that they are aware of the women's movement. They have grown up in a time in which they could not fail to be aware of it.
Though not satisfied, movement leaders say they're encouraged by the number of women the nation's first boomer president has appointed to positions of authority.
You can't have been a person married to Hillary Clinton, I think, for all these years when apparently she has been at least his intellectual equal, if not more, and earning more money than he was, and not understand that it's an advantage, you know, to have the talent of the female half of the population.
The nation's diversity is better reflected in the cabinet and in other top-level policymaking positions, and as U.S. voters become more aware, more sensitive, that diversity is being seen to a greater extent in Congress, too.
Still, women, more than half of the U.S. population, are only 6% of the Senate and 11% of the House of Representatives. Blacks, who make up 12% of all Americans, have 9% of the House seats, but only one member in the Senate. Most agree the struggle for equality and equal representation must go on, but say much of the groundwork has been laid.
I think the women's movement has been very successful in helping recruit many of the new women candidates across the country, and in almost doubling the numbers of women elected to the Congress this year.
I would absolutely not be where I'm sitting today if there was not a civil rights movement.
What will be the driving force behind boomers in government, and how will that affect this nation and the world? Ahead, when Passing the Torch continues. The promises were plentiful and influenced in great part by his baby boom upbringing. Among them, a more open and representative government, less costly health care, more money for education, guaranteed family leave, and stronger environmental protections.
As you think about politics in the 1990s, the first and best question is going to be, what benefits small children?
This is the type of attitude that we need to have in the Congress, that people realize that the actions they're taking today on items such as the deficit and our economy will have a direct impact on the future of our children.
As the best educated generation, Clinton's classmates had the highest SAT scores ever, boomers are committed to raising the smartest, most perfect children, says Strauss.
Anything that boomers think can damage the world of children is going to be frowned upon, it's going to be taxed, it's going to be regulated, it's going to be made illegal.
The differences in how boomers conduct government will be quickly evident, the experts say.
Typical boomer approaches say, look, let's face it, we don't have the resources. There's some people we cannot help, and there's some people we can. It's a no pain, no gain approach.
Yet if they're like the four previous boomer-like generations in this nation's history, their greatest contributions will be far in the future.
There's something about this type of generation, born after a great crisis, coming of age, attacking parents, reaching midlife as moral arbiters, that when they get old, they're the priest warriors who push America into and through the next great crisis in its history.
The most boomer-like generation in American history, historians say, was Abraham Lincoln's. Indulged by early 19th century standards, they were the ones who in the 1820s and 1830s launched spiritual movements and attacked their elders' values on everything from abolition to alcohol.
In their older years, they led the country into and through a great crisis, the Civil War.
They created the largest apocalypse, the most destructive combination of science and spiritualism that the country was capable of having then. If there had been nuclear powers in the North and the South, you better believe that there would have been no Richmond and no Washington standing in 1865.
Whatever crisis is in store for boomer leaders, the authors say if the past holds true, it will far outshadow everything they do during their first years at the helm.
Don't expect a lot to happen in practical policymaking early on in their tenure at power. And early on, what they'll be interested in is fighting the culture wars, getting their values straight.
Particularly among themselves. Boomer-like generations, the historians say, are intolerant of people with different values, even other boomers. They often split into groups with different moral crusades, different ideologies. Yet they're all driven by the same force, values, and that makes them typical boomers.
Our basic understanding of what constitutes good government and a good society is very different from that of the boomers who lead the other party.
What they both have in common is the fixation on symbols matter. Who wins in the Dan Quayle versus Murphy Brown debate? That will decide the fate of the nation. And other generations look at that and think, what are those guys doing?
What boomers are doing is trying to change America, improve the country the only way they learned how when they grew up, by stressing values. It won't be an easy time for this nation if the past holds true. There will be harsh judgments and bitter battles as this generation once again tries to impose its will on others. But as the torches pass, one thing boomers in power won't be is dull. Bonnie Anderson, CNN, Washington.
We have heard the trumpets. We have changed the guard. And now, each in our own way, and with God's help, we must answer the call.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, I'm your brother, Pioneer Deez. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast segment. I have spoken many times on generations. I've spoken many times on the intergenerational war that has been unfolding over the last few decades. And recently I was watching a channel on YouTube, which is really one of my favorites. The guy is incredibly funny. He took a premise created, or at least popularized, I don't think it was created by him, but popularized by Ryan George, which is to have a single person play multiple parts in a skit, and then to put forward some what is essentially a joke, but do it in a very masterful, layered, and often tutorial manner. And so he took what Ryan George was doing and put another little spin on it. And so I love both channels. There's a woman who does it too that, you know, her material is really good too. And it's a great concept and they've done really good things with it. But one of his videos dealt with the almost absurdity of blaming, quote, blaming one generation for the problems of the world, where he was like, well, maybe it's, you know, every generation has these problems and wants to blame another generation. And so I kind of want to talk about that, because no, this really is a standpoint, or not a standpoint, this really is a point that needs to be driven home, that the baby boomers really are the cause of the major issues we are seeing now. Now, to understand this, you have to really get the fact that what we consider contemporary generations, or the idea that we surround generations with, meaning there is some progress associated with them, there is this hyper-cultural change that is notable, this is a contemporary idea that has come about with the maturation brought into existence via what we would think of as the capital industrial revolutions. Especially in the United States, this became this generational idea associated with intense progress. Every 20 to 30 year gap of people are more different, notably, than the previous group of 20 to 30 year people born prior to them. And you notice this change because of not only how much they have changed, but how much society has changed. And this has only really been true. This has been something that this society could say was true for about 150 years. Now, we don't often think about this, but prior to 150 years ago, and for those of you who don't know, that would be roughly back to 1875. While there were changes that occurred in society, and I mean, they were notable, they happened on a much longer scale. So if you were to judge the United States on a generational scale, you wouldn't use 20 or 30 year intervals. You would probably use, if we were just judging how different the people were from generation to generation and how different the society was, you would probably use, well, actually what's maybe interesting about this is that 150 years ago, I probably would still use 30-year intervals for one more generation. So I would go back to 1845, and then I'd start using 50-year intervals. Why? Because, and then prior to that, I would use like 75 to 100-year intervals after maybe two or three cycles of that. Because the differences between each group were so minute, took 50 to 100 years for there to be something notably different between this set of adults, that set of adults, this societal appearance versus that societal appearance. It was only after Europeans became entrenched on this continent, did those changes really start to take hold? And you could really see significant change between the society in this 20 to 30 year period compared to the society in this 20 to 30 year period, the people in this 20 to 30 year period compared to the people in this 20 to 30 year period. And that only became more notable as time progressed beyond that 1875 point. Now, to be honest, I technically wouldn't use 1875, but because we're in 2023, I added a couple of years, 2025, and then combed back 150 years. I would make it a little bit more rigid than, smooth than that, you know. But for the point of talking to you now about this, I'll keep it like this for just a brief moment longer. Now, when I talk about the changes that took place in society, when I talk about the changes that occurred in the groups of people. Understand, from 1845 to 1875, the United States added the, I think right before 1845, actually, they added the Mexican Cession. So they took over half of Mexico. The industrialization in the north really hit a good pace and started it was already transforming the north, but you could definitely see that the north was headed in a different place than the south and what would be the Midwest of the United States. Because of this, the people changed. The cultures were evolving quicker. And that was just this first 30-year period. You go again, 1875 to 1905, you are talking about a drastically metropolis-oriented society where you had cities that were minor hubs of business suddenly become major hubs of business and explode. America began to look very different. And because the American social structure looked very different, so didn't the people born from one 30-year period to another 30-year period. You also had the struggle, especially in this 30-year period, you had the struggle against the excess degradatory aspects of the social changes, which the capitalists were leading. You had the struggle against that, producing real societal recalibration. You had movements that were reshaping how economy was being carried out and how economy was being integrated into the broader society. This, again, it changes the generations. You fast forward again another 30 years. Now you go, and by the way, in that 30-year period, 1875 to 1905, you had a boom bust occur. You had, in the 1880s, you had a huge boom, and then in the 1890s, you had a huge bust, a huge depression. Obviously, 1905 to 1935, obviously you can see where I'm going with that. You had the same thing. But again, culturally, from the 1870s to the early 1900s, 1905, what you had was a society that was drastically rural, country-oriented, that was struggling against not being forced into these city centers, not being forced into these huge industrial cities and forced to work against their will to help make some person who didn't need the money more money. This struggle produced a very different generation. That struggle by the 1910s was pretty much over. Now the struggle was getting the people who didn't need the money but forced you to work so you could produce more money for them. Sound familiar today, huh? Now the struggle was about getting them to treat the people like they were humans and not like they were properties. Just FYI, if somebody's not going to treat you like a human being, they're never going to learn to treat you like a human being. It's not in their structure. You have to deal with that reality. Anyway, this generation learned about those struggles and learned about the valuation of human life. It's kind of interesting that it was this generation born between 1905 and really 1928, 28, 29, maybe 1930, who ultimately, and actually I guess 1930 wouldn't work either, but it was this group of people who ultimately ran off to fight in World War II, whereas it was the previous generation that went off, at least 30-year interval generation, that went off to fight in World War I. Again, this is not a smooth transition. I would have, you know, but you'll see why I'm going through this in a moment, so don't get lost here. And then the society was, again, drastically different. While the boom in the 1880s was not the same as the boom in the 1920s. The boom in the 1880s dealt with a few people getting very, 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 very rich. The one in the 1920s was like, yo, we can all get rich. Everybody get rich. Everybody. And then it fell off the cliff. It was a small group of people, if I remember correctly, it's been a long time since I read this history, in the 1880s that really caused the bust in the 1890s. Whereas it was what we might call over-leveraging and very, very shoddy planning, basically, that caused the bust in the late 1920s. But again, different generation. So when you fast forward another 30 years, you basically are to a point now where the society is moving so quickly. Forget about every 30 years people are looking different. Now you're talking every 20 years people are looking different. So you go from 1935 to 1955, and the people are drastically different. 1955 to 1975, I don't even have to tell you. You could just imagine how different people were from 55 to 75. How about 75 to 95? How about 95 to 2005? Oh, excuse me, to 2015. So here's the thing. Those years were not technically real generations, but I wanted to give you a snapshot of why. When we start talking about culpability, when it comes to these generations, we have to be very, very cognizant of what we're talking about. The real generation markers are much more reliant on astrology and things like that. We don't, in this country, really do a lot with that, so I'm not going to do a lot with that. But for the baby boomers, you have to understand, the baby boomers marked the first time in quite a while when the United States said, we are going to take this group of young people and this group of families, and we are going to set pathways for them to be successful. In other words, the United States government and economic entities said, we are going to make sure that the problems that were faced by the last two generations, maybe three generations, are not here for the baby boomers. We're going to do everything we can to make sure those problems do not slow this generation down. And they didn't do it out of the kindness of their heart. They did it because radicals forced them to, one, but also, two, they had to prove to the rest of the world that the United States was better than it had been acting in the last 50, 60 years. And in order to do that, it couldn't only do a Marshall Plan for Europe, it had to do something spectacular for its own people, and it did. Now, the problem with that was the baby boomers, and again, I'll go back to this conversation that was posted on Documentarian's YouTube channel, where he talked to parents who had baby boomer children. The problem with the decisions that were made was that the young folks being treated to these openings, these opportunities, these pathways, were not told that this was not normal. This was something that had been fought for. This was something that had been bled for. This was something that was forced onto corporations, and that they had been giving these great gifts and these great prizes, not because of their hard work, not because they were special, but because people before them had fought for it. And if these things were to continue into the future, this newer generation would have to save them and make sure that they became permanent. The newer generation did not know this, or at least they didn't care. And so you had a generation that was given everything and grew up very self-centered and self-focused. Now, part of that is because when they came back, and again, Dave Hoffman is the documentarian's name, he had another clip on his channel where an author was talking about how prior to World War II, there were not, and prior to the baby boomer generation, there were not enough people in the United States to do all the jobs. Sound familiar? After the baby boomer generation, or really, after the people came back from World War II, which, by the way, included a lot of people from Europe who wanted to leave Europe because of various issues in Europe, including the fact that most of Europe was devastated after the war. Once when these people came to the United States after the war was over, guess what? There was a lot of people to do jobs. And where there had been a massive labor shortage, that labor shortage had evaporated overnight. And as young people from the baby boomer generation became older, the economy expanded because there was more demand and such. So those people were accommodated. However, after a minute, that accommodation stopped and there weren't enough jobs for everybody. And so people had to learn how to sell themselves and how to be independent and self-focused in order to get work. Whereas prior to World War II, people were community-oriented. They understood that a job was not the end-all, be-all, community was. The new generation, the baby boomers, were cultured in a different way. The atmosphere was different, so they learned different lessons. Well, that's a problem. Because when you have a large group of people who are hyperly competitive and hyperly self-focused, they can either become self-centered or they can become self-actualizing. And for a lot of baby boomers, they became selfish and self-centered and self-focused. They did not become self-actualizing. And there's a huge difference. If you become self-centered, it's about your achievement and your achievement alone. Screw everything else. If you become self-actualizing, you want to share that. So if you get there, you want to show others how to get there. It's a difficult thing to do, though, if you're too driven by your own personal sense of self. They then raised a generation of people who, it was kind of ironic, who were in between being selfish, self-centered, more so, and self-actualizing. They wanted to do stuff, but they didn't just want to do it for themselves. I mean, we often don't analyze the psychocultural nature innate in the movies and the television shows that are broadcast at one single time. And I give Rick Perlstein a lot of credit for doing that in his book, Invisible Bridge. What does it say that the baby boomer generation produced some of the greatest social commentary movies of the 1970s and 80s, yet they also produced some of the most violent, glorifying movies ever produced. And they also produced some of the greatest multi-dimensional movies on lives of teenagers that were fanciful, filled with violence, filled with romantic enthusiasm that ever were made. This was a deep generation with a lot of potential that was lost in the South. As was said in the one clip from David Hoffman's H-O-F-F-M-A-N, his YouTube channel, by the parents who raised baby boomers, they did not understand the processes that went into keeping, even at the level of their parents, what went into keeping a house clean, what went into keeping a house orderly. They took off their socks, threw them in the corner, got home, and those socks were back in the drawer, clean. They did not make the connections, and obviously some of them did, but a lot of them didn't make the connections that this was a process that needed to be kept up every single day. Now, this is important, because many of you may be hearing this and saying, well, what does this have to do with anything? I mean, it's a home. Yeah, yes. The word economy comes from I think it's a Latin word, that means homekeeping or housekeeping. If you don't see the processes in your own home, how are you going to, that, by the way, keeps your home stable, keeps your home orderly, and not orderly in the sense of, oh, well, I'm frightened, orderly. No, orderly as in you can do what you need to do to prosper. If you can't see it in your own home, how are you going to reproduce that in the society? Well, you can. And if your home is unstable, as a lot of homes are, you're going to reproduce, if you don't get the help you need to curb the problems that instability created, you're going to reproduce that instability throughout society. That's what you're going to do. And a lot of baby boomers didn't see the processes. And the ones that they did see, the ones that they did pick up, guess what? They were unstable, and so it created instability in the society. This is why I say, no, this doesn't fall on all generations. This is not a normal set of circumstances. The baby boomer generation was handed the greatest wealth transfer ever in the history of mankind. 200,000 years worth of history. The baby boomer generation was handed the greatest wealth transfer of any group throughout human history. And they were handed it by a generation who, as messed up as that generation was, had fought to give them that type of foundation. The baby boomers had a choice on what they could have done with that transfer. And what they chose to do was to hoard it and to cut the ropes to the next generation trying to climb the same way they climbed to get to the things that they had. I cannot tell you the number of people I have talked to who are 50 years and a little bit younger or a little bit older who have this view of people, forget my age, I'm in the early 30s, but mostly in their 20s, where they're just like, these people are lazy. They're lazy. They don't want to do nothing. They don't want to do this. They don't want to do. And after watching the 50-year-olds, I'm like, dude, most of y'all are not the most supportive people. So what that leads me to believe is, because I know some of these people and I've known them for years, What that leads me to believe is you have tried to cripple these people from a very young age, and now you're pissed off because they're not going out there doing the things that you think they should do because you have crippled them on some level emotionally. Oh, here you go. You're just blaming another generation. I'm not. No. See, this cycle of crippling generations, I think happened to an extent with the baby boomers. The baby boomers pushed back against the hard-nosed nature of the other generation that birthed them. And a lot of that hard-nosed nature from that generation was because of all of the trauma that they had been through. The folks who birthed the baby boomers, who went off to World War II to fight, we often forget. You know, these people were in their late teens, 18, their 20s, their 30s. So let's take this for instance, right? Let's take somebody who is 35 going off to fight in World War II. Obviously, they would probably have some kids. But if they were 35 in 1940, 41, that means they would have been born in 1906, I think. Yes, 1906. From 1906 to that point, they had gone through the Great Depression, the boom and bust in the 1920s. They had gone through World War I, which they probably would have fought in. No, they wouldn't have fought it. They had gone through the many strikes that had been violent. They had gone through the soldier strikes of the late 19-teens, which had been pretty violent. There had been dozens of horrible fights about various topics that had resulted in people literally being killed on the street, being absolutely mangled and hurt because of, you know, one faction not liking another faction. We don't often talk about this stuff, by the way, when it comes to white people. We want to act like white folks had this great history. No, they were fighting each other, killing each other. It was city life. It was city life. In other words, this person lived through a lot of trauma and never was treated for it. So the hard-nosed nature that they had was built on the fact that they weren't comfortable doing anything that suggested stability. If the person was 20 in 1941, that means they were born in 1921. All they knew was economic boom and then bust, that's the Great Depression, and the hardships that came with that, which is traumatic. They could have, through polio and other diseases, they could have lost siblings. They could have lost a parent. But they went over and they fought, which, you know, we often cover over the fact that so many people died. And the United States was really lucky with the number of people who died over there. U.S. lost hundreds of thousands of people. There are countries that lost millions, including Russia. These people, new folks, they may have went over with 50 people from their surrounding region. And they might have been one of a handful to come back. I mean, think about what that does to the psyche. You go from, let's say, a countywide area, and you send 150 people to World War II. And you might be one of 20 or 30 that return. That means it's likely a lot of the people who you knew growing up, dead. Dead. When we talk about homecoming, we fail to realize that there is a connection. There's an older gentleman that I knew years ago who actually made this connection for me. He's like, yeah, most of y'all young people don't know what homecoming is, but we celebrated homecoming because we came home from the war. I'm like, oh, no freaking way. He's like, yeah, that's what homecoming's about, man. I'm like, oh, okay. There was a lot of trauma, in other words. And that trauma, which, you know, I give the Simpsons, you know, I'm a huge Simpsons fan, huge Simpsons fan. The Simpsons have actually tapped into that nearly from the beginning of their run, but it's become much more extravagantly placed and expertly placed in these last 4 or 5 years. They've talked a lot and shown a lot about generational trauma, something that we don't talk enough about. But again, you had a hard-nosed generation raising a generation that was essentially being seeded with a new culture, and that is called the baby boomer generation. The baby boomer generation was given a new culture. It was almost wholly detached from how people had lived prior to them. And part of that new culture was consumerism. I tend to be sympathetic with the baby boomers when it comes to this, because this fact is often overlooked. They were asked to basically reprogram themselves and change patterns that had been ingrained in them based on experiences that had been accumulated over hundreds of years. And they were asked to reprogram themselves as they grew into their adult lives in order to make a new and better society. And it made for some terrifyingly mingled personalities. I haven't ever made this connection before, but I'm going to suggest it right here. I wonder sometimes if that's why there was so much brutality in the way of serial murders and killers and things like that in the late 1960s throughout the 70s, because you were essentially trying to reprogram human nature, especially white human nature, which had developed the way it had developed over a couple thousand years. You were trying to, in a flash of an instance, change that. And that's going to cause some problems. And so, yeah, it did. But this isn't to let them off the hook. Because when the Watergate babies came into office, this was 74, I think, if I remember correctly, when the Watergate babies came into office and really started to take charge of the Congress, one of the things that was notable about them was they, and I want to give a quick shout out to both Rick Perlstein and Matt Stoller, his book Goliath, helped me kind of see this. They were really, really, really adamant on the idea that the past doesn't matter. Whatever you did to get here, we don't give a darn about the past. We are going to chart something new. And it was their egotism that led them to adopt economic policies that would be not only detrimental to the same foundation that they were benefiting from, it would actually work to destroy it and break it apart, but it would also cause hell throughout the country. And because they were so dogmatic about the desire to chart this new way and not listen to people who had come before them, they picked up ideas and concepts and the like that not only did it cause problems throughout society, but the more they refused to listen and the harder they doubled down on, no, this is going to work, this is going to work, this is going to work, the more estranged from the society they became. Remember, this is a generation who already was very self-centered. They didn't see a connection between themselves and society anyway. So if the things they were doing was hurting society, well, I don't really need to worry about that because it's working for me. It's working for me. Well, it may be working for you, but the reason why it's working for you in the present tense and why it's going to work in the future is because you're tearing up these million people over here in order to make it work for you. But that doesn't matter because you're self-centered. The baby boomer generation laid down on a foundation built thoroughly by radical engagement. And without knowing that that's what happened, without caring that that's what happened, they got up in the morning and took a hatchet to that foundation. And then claimed, as they left the room and passed it on to another generation, that, well, it doesn't matter. I worked hard for what I had. What's wrong with you? And then when that generation, the newer generation, said, but wait a minute. So you built this bed? This foundation here? You built this? Well, yeah, of course I built it. Why wouldn't I have built it? My hard work built it. No. I have this journal here of people that came before you that said they built it and they gave it to you. Is that true? Then the baby boomers want to get quiet. Okay, so yes, they built it for you. So why did you destroy it so I can't have it? Well, see, now you're just being lazy because, I mean, it's not that hard. You can fix that. You can fix it. Just fix it. Fix it. And you'll be fine. I'm out of here. This is kind of where we're at right now. And baby boomers who did not want to listen, this is why the okay boomer thing started. Baby boomers did not want to listen, but they wanted to talk down to the new generation. And the new generation got sick of that. And that's when they started coming out with, okay boomer, all right boomer, you know so much, okay boomer. As I watched this happen a couple of years back when after Michael Brown was killed and black folks started marching, and I saw some black folks on Facebook, older black folks, critiquing these young people. Oh, you're just wasting time. Marching ain't never got us nowhere. You are just wait da da da. And it got to me finally, and I wrote one of them. And I said, okay, let me ask you something, my man. You doing political education stuff where you at? Because I see you're in one of the cities where this stuff is popping off. So are you actually putting together political education, packets and stuff and going out there and teaching these young kids? So with the stuff that you say, by the way, you are a professor in your late 50s. So you know how to do this. Are you teaching them what you're yelling at them about? He didn't respond. But he kept posting the bullcrap, so I went on to the next post. See, y'all are cowards. You're going to sit on the sideline yelling at these young kids who are putting their lives on the line right now, doing the work. You could be out there teaching them instead of just yelling at them. But you ain't going to do it. You're just going to sit there and you're going to curse at them about how they're stupid. You're cowardly. You're cowardly. I don't care what you've done in the past. You're cowardly. That got a response. How dare you, young man? What do you know about me? First, I'm in my mid-30s, or my early 30s. At the time I was. First, I'm in my early 30s. So I'm not a young man anymore. And number two, you tell me I'm wrong. Because the people in your generation had to go through that same nonsense with some of the elders of the previous generation when you was out there marching for stuff. So what are you doing? Me and him had a conversation after that. I've done that to a couple of white elders too. I didn't want to have to, but I had to. And what ultimately came of it was an understanding that, look, you're going to critique all you want. I'm fine with that. But what you doing to resolve the problem? Baby boomers have had the society cater to them since before they were born. I mean, do you understand? Baby boomers literally had this society catering to them before they were born. It was understood by government bureaucrats. I know, oh, the bureaucrats. Y'all don't even know what a bureaucrat is good for. You listening to people who hate government because they're rich. And I know, they must be doing something right because they're rich. But seriously, you need to stop listening to those people. Anyway, government bureaucrats understood that when folks came back from World War II, because it was clear, I think it was by the mid-1943, that look, the U.S. and the Allies were going to win it. It was becoming very clear. They just didn't know how much longer, and they didn't know what the human cause would be, but they knew they were going to win. They also knew when these people came back, you were going to be looking at a population explosion. After just about every war, there's a slight uptick to some degree of population, unless the people on one side are dead. But they knew there was going to be an explosion. They also knew there was going to be a bunch of immigrants coming here, and that was going to also cause a rise in the population. So they had to figure out something to do with this new spike. They also had to figure out what to do to stop the riot that almost took place in, what was it, 1919, 1921? When the World War I soldiers who had not been paid almost rioted, and there was a confrontation there that didn't look well for the government. They wanted to not allow that to happen. They knew they had to do something different, and hence the GI Bill was born. So wasn't a host of programs to restructure the society towards families. Did you hear what I just said? And by the way, if you want to know a little bit more about this, go and grab the book, A Consumer's Republic. A Consumer's Republic. A Consumer's Republic. This woman who wrote this book, Elizabeth Cohen, does not get enough credit for this book. Because it's a fascinating book, A Consumer's Republic. A Consumer's Republic. I read this thing 10 years ago. It had a huge impact on how I started understanding the processes that went into creating the baby boomer generation. These people had to actually create structure, social structure within the society to make the society more family friendly. Most of your suburbs owe their existence to the planning sessions that took place between 1942 and 1945, because it was during those planning sessions that the United States government figured out that it would subsidize housing, that it would build these communities for these families, things like that. All of this was done then. When those people came back, when those soldiers came back and they started having families, the government had everything planned out to help them take those families and prosper. Mostly white families. And they did. But the baby boomers knew nothing about that. They knew nothing about it. Well, now they do. And for the younger generation, because the baby boomers generation didn't protect those programs, didn't pass them on to you, now you have to do for yourself what the government did for them. Well, you have to technically force the government to do what it did for them, which is build institutions that enable families to prosper. That's it. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. I'm your brother, Vimer Dees Ogaya. If you like the work I'm doing here, support me. Patreon, Cash, not Patreon, I'm sorry, I'm not on Patreon yet. Cash App, PayPal, CWB Podcast, help me out. Guys, $2, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50, whatever you could do, help me out. As I said before, and I'm going to keep saying it, I know there are people who are wealthy, or at least a lot wealthier than I am, who use my my podcast. I know it, because I've heard them cite ideas without citing my podcast. I'm fine with that. But if you're going to use it, if you're going to write a paper on something that I spoke about that you never heard before, you're going to write a book using some of what I've talked about here. Guys, throw me a little money. Throw me a little money. Thank you. And I'll see you on the next one, y'all. I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month and a year. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lights in the balance.